much. First, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this very nice place. And second, I would like to thank the organizers for organizing this workshop, because I think the kilohertz gravitational waves have been kind of neglected, maybe, because they are hard to measure. But I think they really bear a lot of potential, as I will also discuss in my talk. So I really appreciate that you push for this frequency range. And the argument is pretty simple, why kilohertz gravitational waves are so interesting. So if you speak about neutron stars, and I think we should also speak about neutron stars because they connect to a lot of different interesting fields in physics, and we compute the dynamical timescale of a neutron star like this, 10 kilometers in size, a mass of, let's say, 1.4 solar masses. So we find that the dynamical timescale or typical timescale of a neutron star is milliseconds, and therefore the relevant frequency range is kilohertz. And that's the reason why we should think about kilohertz gravitational wave emission. So that's the motivation. That's the outline of my talk. I guess it's a little bit too much, but please feel free to interrupt me anytime. I prefer that we discuss a bit more, and therefore we can skip stuff at the end. So I will start with a very broad motivation and introduction, and we'll also try to speak a little bit about things which are not yet worked out, but which will come in the future, in a few years from now, maybe. Then I want to speak about the dominant post-merger frequency, and I want to show you that this frequency is very, very interesting to determine the unknown radius of a neutron star. And we'll also have one or two slides on gravitational wave data analysis aspects, measuring this frequency. And then I want to speak a little bit about secondary features in the post-merger gravitational wave spectrum. We heard already an example, this spiral mode. Here I want to discuss two other mechanisms that are generating subdominant features in the gravitational wave spectrum, and I want to show you how you can embed this in a unified picture of the post-merger dynamics and how you can really connect a gravitational wave feature in the spectrum to the underlying dynamics of the remnant, which is also important if you want to speak about multi-messenger astronomy of these events, about the electromagnetic counterpart, for instance, because these post-merger dynamics should leave an impact on the electromagnetic counterpart. And I might also discuss a little bit the equation of state dependence of these secondary features. And then the last point that I want to touch is the collapse behavior. So the question whether when the two neutron stars merge, if they directly form a black hole on a dynamical timescale, on a timescale of a millisecond, or if they form a neutron star remnant that possibly collapses to a black hole on a somewhat longer timescale. Could be 5 milliseconds, could be 100 milliseconds, or could be even longer. What I mean by collapse behavior is just a distinction between a prompt collapse and no prompt collapse. I want to show you that based on these considerations, we can come up with a very robust lower limit on neutron star radii. And in the future, we will be also able to determine the maximum mass of non-rotating neutron stars, which is very hard to assess otherwise. So for the motivation for kilohertz gravitational waves, I want to sketch two points. The first is that by measuring kilohertz gravitational waves, we can, of course, learn something about unknown properties of high-density matter. And the other thing is, as I said already, the kilohertz gravitational wave emission can tell us something about the underlying dynamics of the post-merger, and therefore we can connect it with the electromagnetic emission and also with the R process and so on that is taking place in the ejector of neutron star mergers. So let me start with the equation of state. What you see here is a snapshot of high density matter and high temperature, but this snapshot is not taken from a neutron star merger simulation, but from a heavy ion collision. So the point that I want to make is simply that there are a lot of efforts going on to understand high density matter at zero temperature and also at higher temperature. So you see here the phase diagram of matter temperature as a function of the chemical potential. And you see that there are really many experimental efforts where people build big accelerators to assess precisely this part of this phase diagram. So here you see the different instruments which are already existing or will be built. And on top of this, I was drawing here where neutron star mergers lie. And you see that this is really overlapping. You know? So there are two different approaches to assess the properties of high density matter and high temperature matter. So when we speak about the equation of state and high density matter, things that we are interested in are the properties of nuclear matter, for instance, the stiffness of nuclear matter, and we want to determine, for instance, also nuclear parameters like the symmetry energy and so on, which is relevant for nuclear physics models, also to describe, for instance, the rapid neutron capture process. We need to determine these nuclear parameters. Another question is, of course, what are the fundamental constituents of high density matter? Hyperons are expected to occur, kaons, muons, and so on. Another important question is also the transition to deconfined quark matter. How does this confinement functions, which is not very well understood because this is really a part of QCD that cannot be easily assessed by model. And of course, the other point is that the equation of state is also critical for many things in astrophysics, for neutron star cooling, for the explosion mechanisms of quark collapse supernovae, and so on. And therefore, we are very much interested in determining the equation of state, and in particular, neutron star radii, which are uniquely linked to the equation of state, at least to the cold equation of state. So here I want to speak mostly about the post-merger gravitational waves, which are in the kilohertz range. And I want to argue that measuring post-merger gravitational waves is, on the one hand, similar to in-spiral methods, but on the other hand, it's also complementary. So it's similar in the sense that we can assess the properties of the cold equation of state and that we can determine, for instance, neutron star radii and the tidal deformability by measuring post-merger gravitational waves. Okay? And that's, I think, something that is important just to cross-check what people derive from the in-spiral phase. You know that there are still some systematic problems for instance, when you construct templates for the in-spiral phase. But it's also complementary in the sense that with the post-merger remnant, you typically probe the high density regime of the equation of state, simply because the densities in the merger remnant increase compared to the densities in the original stars. So you get access to the really high density part of the equation of state. And you also get a handle on temperature effects in the post-merger remnant. Okay, everybody knows this probably, so currently we have many different equation of state models on the market. Here I just put a few that I found on the computer, and you know that they are uniquely linked to the stellar properties of neutron stars, so every equation of state determines here mass-radius relation, and we do not know the true mass-radius relation, and that's the reason why we want to measure neutron star radii. Of course, not all the equations of state that I showed here are still compatible with what we know now about the properties of neutron stars. So the very stiff ones here with large radii and the very soft ones with small radii can probably be ruled out. But the goal is that in the future we measure here the mass radius relation of neutron stars and then we can go back and determine the equation of state. The other point that I want to make is the connection to the electromagnetic counterpart and to the mass ejection of neutron star mergers. So you see here snapshots from a merger simulation color-coded is the rest mass density. And all these dots are fluid elements that get eventually unbound. And this is the material that is producing the heavy elements that is also producing the electromagnetic counterpart by radioactive case. And you see that for such a symmetric merger, a lot of material is squeezed out between the two neutron stars from the contact interface. But it's not yet getting directly unbound here. It needs an additional push from the oscillations and the rotation of the remnant that is pushing here the material in addition so that it's getting unbound. Okay? And that's, of course, just to make the point here, for instance, the bolometric luminosity of an electromagnetic counterpart scales approximately with the square root of the ejector mass. So you see a little bit how the dynamics link to the mass ejection. You see here as a function of time, the ejector mass in blue as it increases, and this is the central lapse function, which encodes the dynamics of the remnant, the oscillations of the remnant. And you see that when the lapse function here, when the compactness oscillates of the remnant and the lapse function increases, which means that the remnant is in an expansion phase, then it produces here this increase of the ejector. You see when the dots here turn white, then they become unbound, and you see that it's exactly in such an expansion phase of the remnant. Okay? So here the dynamics are directly linked with the mass ejection and therefore also with the electromagnetic counterpart. You can see this also here. So here you see similar plots. This is again the lapse function which encodes here, for instance, the quasi-radial oscillations of the remnant, and you see that here in the expansion phase of the remnant, in the very first cycle, you unbind most of the material. But you see that the Sanford, for different models, for different equations of state, the lapse function can also look differently here with different frequency content, and then the mass ejection proceeds differently. And everything, of course, depends also on the binary parameters, the mass ratio, the total mass, and so on. This is also to show you what is the impact of the equation of state on the ejecta mass. So this is the ejecta mass inferred from many different simulations for different equations of state. And here I characterize the equations of state by the radius of 1.35 solar mass neutron star, just to characterize the stiffness of the equations of state. And you see that stiff equations of state with large radii produce small ejecta masses, and soft equations of state produce high ejecta masses. The reason for this is simply that if you have a compact neutron star, the stars orbit around each other a little bit longer. Therefore, they collide with a higher impact velocity, which is measured here. Therefore, this merger proceeds more violent, more material is squeezed out, and the remnant also oscillates heavier. And therefore, you unbind more matter, and you get here the higher ejecta. And you find something similar here for asymmetric mergers. Okay? This is just to give you an idea that there's really a lot of things are going on depending on the equation of state, depending on the binary masses. And this is all encoded in the dynamics of the post-merger remnant that we can assess by gravitational waves. Another point is also that the mass ejection and the properties of the electromagnetic counterpart on the conditions for launching a short gamma ray burst depend critically on the collapse behavior. So if you form a black hole or if you form a neutron star remnant, and that's of course also something that can be probed by post-merger gravitational wave emission, because if you measure post-merger gravitational waves, it tells you that there was a neutron star remnant, while if you directly formed a black hole, then you don't measure post-merger gravitational waves because the black hole rings at much higher frequencies and we can't. And that's the point that I wanted to make before, that in principle, the kilohertz gravitational waves encode the dynamics of the remnant, and they should be linked to the properties of the electromagnetic counterpart. But here, really, the details still need to be worked out. Okay, so let me speak a little bit about the dominant post-merger gravitational wave emission and how we can measure neutron star radii. You see here a typical gravitational wave spectrum from a simulation where you do not directly form a black hole, where you have either a delayed collapse or no collapse at all. And you see, so the thick line is the full spectrum. We miss, of course, a lot of power from the inspiral phase because the simulations just start a few orbits before the merger. The thin line is what you get if you just focus on the post-merger phase just by windowing the signal. And you see that there is a lot of structure in the post-merger phase, and every single peak here tells you something about the properties, the stellar structure of this remnant and the dynamics. So what I would like to stress is that this is quite a generic spectrum. So in all these spectra or in all these simulations where you do not form a black hole directly, you find such a pronounced peak, which I will call F peak. Some people call it F2 or whatever. Okay? So on the next slides, I will focus here on this frequency peak, because this peak will sensitively depend on the equation of state and on the binary masses.
So before I go on, I was just wondering if you could say a little bit about, so you're doing these simulations in the conformal flat mm-hmm. approximation, right? So you don't actually have gravitational waves, degrees of freedom in your metric, right? So can you say a little bit how you're calculating the gravitational waves and what sort of systematic effects that might have that you're not including that in the metric?
There are two things. This scheme incorporates a post-Newtonian back reaction scheme to take into account the effects of gravitational waves, because this you need for actually getting the merger. And then the extraction is done with a post-Newtonian quadrupole formula.
Okay, so just directly from the stress energy tensor, I'm assuming?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And if you compare it to full GR, then you find a very good agreement, in particular of the frequencies. Maybe I have a plot at the end I need to check. So I think there are hardly any systematic uncertainties because of this change.
Well, I mean, I'd be a little bit surprised if like post-Newtonian was that good right at the merger. And so you're not really feeding back the loss of these gravitational waves.
Yeah.
So like this hypermassive neutron star is oscillating, losing energy to gravitational waves, mm-hmm. but you're not feeding that back into like a back reaction on the star, right?
Yes. And I mean, I made comparisons to full GR, and you really find that the frequencies lie on top of each other. So I'm relatively confident about this G. Okay, so what I want to do now is to discuss here the dependence on the equation of state of this frequency. So to this end, I perform many simulations for this binary setup, two stars of 1.35 solar masses for all these different equations of state. Then I extract this peak frequency from the simulations. And then what I do in order to understand the equation of state dependence is that I just plot for every simulation this peak frequency as the function of the radius of 1.35 solar mass neutron star. So just the radius of the inspiraling stars. And then you see that the peak frequency here nicely scales with this radius of non-rotating neutron star, which means if you measure this frequency, you can invert this relation. You get an idea about the radius of a non-rotating neutron star. And of course, doing such a plot is a pure choice. I can use here any other quantity that I like to describe a given equation of state. And so I can start playing around. And I can use the same set of simulations, the same peak frequencies, and can plot them, for instance, also as function of the radius of 1.8 solar mass neutron star, 1.6 solar mass neutron star, or the radius of the maximum mass configuration. Okay? And just by playing around, you find that the relation becomes particularly tight if you use here the radius of 1.6 solar mass neutron star. You know, it's 1.5 or 1.7, doesn't matter too much. Okay? The reason for this is simply that the density regime that you find in a 1.6 solar mass neutron star reflects the density regime in a rotating remnant. And that's the reason why this relation here gets particularly tight. Okay? Here you see it then a bit better. So the maximum deviation here in this relation is less than 200 meters, which is setting the systematic error bar when you do here the radius measurement after you determined the peak frequency. So this is just to show you that similar relations exist also for other total binary masses. So here for two stars with 1.2 solar masses or two stars with 1.5 solar masses. And you see every time when you consider a fixed binary mass, you get such a relation that you can invert. And also, the mass ratio doesn't have a big impact on the peak frequency. So here, if you consider a relation for a fixed shear mass and you use symmetric and asymmetric mergers, you see that there is still kind of course, a somewhat broader relation, but there is still a relation because the mass ratio doesn't have a big impact on this dominant frequency of the remnant because the remnant somehow forgets the initial mass ratio of the binary system. Okay, so even if in a future event you do not have any information about the mass ratio, then you can still use such a relation here to determine neutron star radius. But I guess for mergers where you have a chance to actually measure the post-merger emission, you will also have a very precise measurement of the binary masses.
Can I quickly ask you? I can see the scales are almost always between 2 kilo in frequency, 2 kilohertz and 3.5, 4 kilohertz. That means that it's okay. You can vary the mass ratio, I guess the spin, but 2 to 4 kilohertz is the place very robustly predicted to be where you will have the peak frequency.
Exactly. You will not find a lot of merger simulations up here simply because here the remnant becomes so compact that it collapses to a black hole, so you will not find this frequency. So this range between 2 and 4 is quite generic, independent of the mass, independent of the equation of state. In a moment, I will also show you some data analysis simulations, but I refer also to all these papers here which started to assess the possibility of really measuring this peak frequency from a simulation, from a detection. The conclusion overall is, I guess, that you can determine this frequency relatively accurate, which means that this is a relatively small contribution to the total error of your radius measurement. So the final strategy for a radius measurement from the post-merger phase is that you measure the binary masses from the inspiral, then you construct a relationship with simulations between the peak frequency and the radius, or optimally chosen radius. you measure this peak frequency from the post-merger phase, and then you invert this relation to get the radius, okay? The final error of such a measurement, of course, depends on the accuracy of your f-peak measurement and on the systematic errors in this relation between the peak frequency and the radius, where you have, of course, an intrinsic scatter because you don't know the true equations of state. So you need to take into account all possible candidate equations of state. And if you include the most extreme model that you could imagine, then this gives you the systematic error in this relation and also the contributes to the error of the final radius measurement here. So this is a slide on gravitational wave data analysis of how to measure this post-merger phase. So this is a work in collaboration with James Clark, and you see here the results from a principal component analysis. So the dashed curve is the injected waveform, and you see what you can reconstruct with the solid curve here from such a principal component analysis. You see that you really can recover the peak frequency very well. And these simulations exclude the candidate waveform that was injected, and you reconstruct the waveform just with a catalog of other waveforms. Here you see for different existing and planned or projected instruments, the detection horizon and the expected detection rate. And I should stress that we were very conservative when we assumed here a merger rate. So this number here is outdated. You see that here from the detection horizon, you can measure such a signal at a few 10 megaparsecs. So this is something that might become really interesting if you get a similar event like the last one at design sensitivity. Okay.
Great. Another ignorant question, if you don't mind. Does the spin of the neutron star affect this F peak, and how much?
Basically, it does not affect the F peak. The reason is simply that most of the angular momentum in the remnant originates from the orbital angular momentum. And that's so much larger than any spin that a neutron star could have.
Yeah. Okay.
And if you check the observed neutron star binaries, the fastest has something like, I think, 17 milliseconds or something, spin period. And that's very, very slow compared to 2 milliseconds orbital period before merging. And you can also show this with simulations that the spin basically doesn't have any impact there. Okay. So now let me speak a little bit about subdominant gravitational wave features, which can be used also to learn more about the equation of state, and which can be used to learn something about the post-merger dynamics. We heard already one aspect of this is the development of a spiral mode. Another thing that I will also not discuss here is that there might be modes that are CFS unstable and that could grow on a longer time scale. But that's something that is possibly also very interesting, because measuring such an emission could tell you something about the long-term evolution and the long-term fate of the remnant, if you measure, for instance, a CFS unstable F mode, for instance. So that's also something that could be very interesting, but I think many, many things still need to be worked out here. So this is here just one more comment on the dominant oscillation frequency. So here you see again the gravitational wave spectrum, and you can used such a simulation, and you can at a late time add by hand a velocity perturbation that is designed in a way to re-excite the F mode. And then you see that the emission occurs here exactly at this frequency. So this is an argument that this dominant frequency or this dominant peak here is produced by the F mode. That's a more sophisticated analysis here, where you can really extract the eigenfunction of a given mode at a given frequency, and you see this very nice quadrupolar structure at this F peak frequency. Okay? So there is quite some good evidence that the dominant peak here is produced by the fundamental F. But you see, if you have a look here to the gravitational wave spectrum, there is a lot of substructure, and I want to focus now in particular on these two features here at lower frequencies, where we have, of course, higher chances to measure.
Sorry, can you go back to the previous slide? Are you saying that if you do perturbation of this remnant star, abnormal frequency is the same as your peak frequency.
Yes. Yes.
So are you using the total? You're just using the same total mass, or what? Are you...
No, I really take the simulation. Wait until most of the oscillations are damped, that I don't have any gravitational wave emission left. And then I just add a fluid perturbation, a small fluid perturbation, in the dump step, in the dump file.
I mean, do you not expect these things to collapse once they sort of lose all their angular momentum and cool down?
No, it still has angular momentum. It's rotating. It's still rotating, but it's not oscillating very strong. I just wait for, I don't know, 20 milliseconds, 30 milliseconds or something, so that the remnant is not oscillating so much, and then I add a perturbation.
So you really have some sort of differentially rotating, but
yes.
Like
yes.
Background solution?
Yes. 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 And then I add a perturbation that is just this, you know, there are many people that thought about isolated neutron stars, so these techniques are well established, right? And this, I'm just doing the same here for the merger remnant.
Yeah.
Of course.
I'm just wondering because here it's something that is like differentially rotating and hot and all these things.
It's still hot. It's still differentially rotating. But I just add this perturbation, and you see, by just adding this perturbation, I excite exactly this frequency. Now, I also did this with other stuff, so I can also re-excite the radial frequency, for instance. We will come to this point. But I think that's an interesting technique just to be sure which modes we are actually speaking about. So now it's about the nature and the mechanisms that are producing these peaks here at lower frequencies, because these are peaks that are possibly accessible by gravitational wave detectors. And the question is now, which of these peaks, or how do you produce these peaks? And one idea was that you could have a coupling between the quasi-radial mode, which doesn't emit gravitational waves on its own, but this mode could couple to the F mode. And then you would expect a frequency or side peaks to the dominant peak, okay? So the question is now, what is the quasi-radial mode of such a remnant? And to this end, I do something similar as before. I add a perturbation to the remnant at late times to figure out what is the mode. So you see here, this is the time evolution of the lapse function, which encodes the compactness of the remnant. And you see that there, in this particular model, exist at least two frequencies, one with about 1,000 hertz and one with about 500 hertz. So it's not so clear which of these frequencies is now the quasi-radial frequency of the remnant. But if you add a velocity perturbation to re-excite the quasi-radial mode, you see that this 1,000 hertz oscillation is the quasi-radial mode of the remnant. Okay? Actually, 1,100 hertz. Okay?
So this is isotropic. So it is isotropic mode? So it's just
quasi-radial, yes. Yes. So and what you see now is, if we take the dominant frequency peak here, 2.6 kilohertz minus 1.1 kilohertz, you exactly end up here. So this provides very strong evidence that this peak is produced by this coupling between the radial mode and the F mode. And you find the corresponding side peak at higher frequencies when you take the F peak plus the F zero. Okay. So the question is now, of course, how do we generate this feature? And to understand this, we should have a look to this movie, and you will recognize that here, directly after merging, you form here such bulges at the outer edges of the remnant. Okay? You see it a little bit better here. So I'm speaking about this material here, okay? And here and here. So just these are the very first milliseconds after merging. So the inner parts of the stars merge and they form this central part of the remnant, but when they merge, the stars get tightly stretched, and this material here, these bulges, cannot follow the faster rotation of the inner remnant. Okay? And so this material is orbiting with a lower rate around the central part of the remnant. Just to track this, I indicated or I colored here a few fluid elements. And what you see is that from going from here to there, from this snapshot to this snapshot, they completed approximately one orbit, right? The black dots are up here, and here they are again up here. If you compare now the times here, this is about a millisecond. So this would be an orbital period of these bulges here of 1 millisecond, and then you expect a gravitational wave emission at 2 kilohertz because you need to multiply with a factor 2, right? If we go back to the spectrum, you find here a peak precisely at 2 kilohertz, okay? There's further evidence, so you can try to somehow measure the mass of these bulges and can compute how much gravitational wave emission do you expect if you have two bulges of 0.1 solar masses going around with this frequency for a few milliseconds, then you see that the amplitudes fit. And you can do other stuff that provides really evidence that this one feature is produced by the orbital motion of these bulges. This is something else that I want to show you. This is just to show that's a spectrogram here, frequency as function of time. And this is just to show you that there are really discrete frequencies in the spectrogram. It's not a time, it's they are really relatively stable frequencies which are producing here these features in the gravitational wave spectrum. And this is for another equation of state where you have here this 2 minus 0 coupling between the two different modes. So now we can put all this information, all these mechanisms together in a kind of unified picture. So if we have a look to many different simulations, many different masses, many different equations of state, you find the following systematics. So this dominant peak is always present in all the simulations. Then you find if you have a particularly high total binary mass and a soft equation of state, then you have this 2 minus 0 feature, this mode coupling, very pronounced, while this feature here is suppressed. On the other hand, if you have a low total binary mass or relatively stiff equation of state, then this thing here is basically absent, but this F spiral feature, these bulges, these tidal bulges are very pronounced. Okay? You see it here, so these are different simulations for the same binary mass, but different equations of state. Here you see a spectrum where this 2 minus 0 feature is very pronounced, while here it's absent. And then you have these intermediate cases where both features, both secondary features have a comparable strength, approximately. Okay? So we can roughly classify gravitational wave spectra with these three types. Either one or the other is present, or both are present with comparable strength. And you see these different types are also reflected, for instance, in the evolution of the central lapse function, which is somehow tracking the dynamics of the post-merger remnant. So if you have these 2 minus 0 feature very pronounced, then it's pronounced because you have a strong excitation of the radial mode, and therefore this coupling becomes very strong. And you see this precisely here. So here the central lapse function really oscillates very heavily. While here, in the type 3, where you don't have this 2 minus 0 feature pronounced, but the F spiral feature, you have a much different behavior of the central lapse function. And actually, you see, this frequency here corresponds to the quasi-radial frequency of the remnant, and you see that it's really not very much pronounced here. So this is another frequency that you see here. Okay. And this all makes very much sense here, because what's going on here is that if you have very massive neutron stars and very soft, compact neutron stars, when they collide with a higher impact velocity, they collide more violently, and they produce a very strong excitation of this radial mode. Okay? And therefore, this 2 minus 0 feature is very strongly pronounced. Compact neutron stars with high masses are also stronger bound, and therefore this formation of the tidal bulges is suppressed, and that's the reason why this feature in that case is absent. On the other hand, if you have low mass neutron stars or stiff equations of state, the merging proceeds in a relatively smooth manner, and you don't excite this radial frequency of the remnant very strongly, and therefore this coupling is also absent. But if you have low mass neutron stars, they are not so strongly bound, and you really produce these tidal bulges that you saw in the movie very, very massively. Okay? And then this feature here gets very pronounced, as you see it here in this type. in this spectrum. Okay, so this classification really makes sense, and it makes sense that we see the different peaks with different strengths depending on the underlying dynamics. I listed here the different definitions of these different types, and let me just mention that as I try to convince you that there is really a reason why we find these peaks suppressed or pronounced in one or the other case. And you also find the impact of these different dynamics also in other quantities, for instance, the gravitational wave amplitude or also the maximum density of the remnant. So,
how robust are these subdominant peak frequencies to physics that's not included in the current models of simulations, like magnetic fields, for example?
There are not so many simulations, right, with magnetic fields and microphysical equations of state and so on. Generally, I think frequencies are something that are relatively robust because it's hard to imagine, for instance, that these tidal bulges are very much affected by magnetic fields because you have high magnetic fields, but they are not so high that they really have a dramatic impact on the stellar structure. And what determines frequencies in general is the stellar structure. So the magnetic fields probably have an impact on the damping of the remnant and so on, and the redistribution of angular momentum. But the frequencies, I mean, these frequencies are produced in the very first milliseconds after merging, right? And magnetic fields need time to build up, and they have probably only an impact on a longer time scale. So in principle, I think that these frequencies are relatively robust.
So how much time does it take for the field to build up after a merger?
It starts building up right away. But first it starts building up in a shear layer where you have these Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities between the stars. But the fields are depending on the initial field strength, I mean, they remain relatively small compared to what you need to really affect the stellar structure, right? So that's why I would argue that magnetic fields only have an effect on the long-term behavior to redistribute angular momentum. So,
yeah. Is it something like 100 milliseconds?
No, much faster, much faster.
Yeah. For magnetic field buildup time, is it like
10 milliseconds? And also, in some sense, we're probably underestimating all these effects because, you really have to resolve the small-scale physics to actually get the full amount of energy that's going to be transferred from the small-scale kinetic motion to the magnetic field. So, it seems like you throw more resolution at these things, you see higher magnetic fields. So, it's probably somewhat biased in the answer.
That might be, but as you argued, we don't have the final answer yet. Yes. But I mean, it's on the other hand, it's really kind of hard to imagine that you really get fields that are really affecting the stellar structure a lot, right?
Well, I mean, people are talking about sort of building up magnetar-level magnetic fields post-merger.
Yeah, but that's 10 to 15, and that's still a few orders of magnitude away from equipartition, where you would start to affect the structure, right?
People are talking about sort of few percent or maybe more of the kinetic energy is in the magnetic energy. But you could imagine that has some effect on these differentially rotating
events. Sure, but it will probably take a bit time, right? So.
Yeah, it's maybe ballpark comparable to these timescales you're talking about.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, we don't know yet at the moment, right? I guess we agree.
Yeah, will affect the differential rotation, right? So if you get to the planetar,
but these features are produced on timescale of really the first milliseconds, right? And so for me it's not easy to imagine that you can build up the magnetic field so quickly that they can have an impact already in the first milliseconds. On long run, certainly, but at the beginning. The point is also, the most of the material is actually not really differentially rotating. What you have are two irrotational cores of the initial stars that are orbiting around each other, and they are just rubbing against each other, right? And the magnetic fields are going on in the shear layer. But the cores of the stars are still irrotational, where you probably don't build up magnetic fields very, very fast. So the magnetic fields have an impact mostly in this shear layer between the two stars. But I mean, again, we don't have the final answer yet, because nobody can afford a resolution to really resolve this, all the effects which are going on in this shear layer.
So you talk about this different classification based on the compactness of the star. Have you investigated the dependence on the mass ratio of the magnet, like whether different mass ratio will give you different type of
Not in very much detail. I investigated this in the sense that I checked small deviations from equal mass systems, and then you get the same. What's generally going on is that if you have more asymmetric mergers, they merge in a sense smoother, because you have this tidal disruption of the less massive binary component. And so, for instance, this quasi-radial mode is usually not very much excited if you have very asymmetric mergers. So what you see here is for symmetric mergers and mergers which are relatively close, say mass ratio 0.9. So, but what you see here is what I described before, that so these are for different equations of state. The types that you get for a simulation, if you have 1.2 mergers, then I plot the type at 1.2 solar masses. That's the way to read this diagram. And what you see is that if you focus on a given equation of state, as you go to higher masses, you get the type 1 mergers, the type 1 gravitational wave spectra, which are the ones which have this very strong coupling between the radial mode. Because, again, the stars are compact, you excite this radial mode very strongly, and therefore you get this 2 minus 0 feature pronounced, and these tidal bulges are suppressed. Okay? Here, for instance, you see it very nicely that you go from low masses, starting with type 3, to higher masses, to type 2, and then to type 1. Okay. Of course, this is all just a tentative classification, because one cannot really quantitatively classify these different spectra. I don't want to go into the details here. I explained to you why this whole picture makes sense physically. Let me just mention that also here, this frequency can be understood, and that's simply if you have here these bulges that are forming, they also affect the overall compactness of the remnant. So if you have these tidal bulges, the remnant alternates basically between these two different configurations. Either the bulges are aligned with the principal axis of the remnant, or they are anti-aligned. And this is a configuration that is more compact than this one. And so this has then, the orientation has then here an impact on the central lapse function. So this is, these tidal bulges can also explain why you find here this frequency, which is not the quasi-radial frequency of the remnant. Okay, just a few words on the dependency of these frequencies. So here you see, as a function of the compactness for these binary systems, these different frequencies, there's the F peak that we discussed at the beginning, that's the F spiral, and that's the 2 minus 0 feature. What you learn from all this is basically that they all scale in a similar way with the compactness of neutron stars. Okay. This is the spiral feature, and that's the 2 minus 0 feature for different masses, and you see they all increase with the compactness, and the higher the mass, the higher is also the frequency. Maybe to summarize the frequency dependence, I show you just this plot here. So this is the F spiral frequency for fixed binary mass as a function of the F peak frequency. And that's the 2 minus 0 as a function of the F peak. And you see they all scale very similarly with this peak frequency, which is maybe a bad news, because it means that the peak frequency and the secondary features contain more or less the same information about the equation of state. Okay. So we really need to go into the details to understand what we can learn from these secondary features. Okay, So in my last minutes, let me just speak a little bit about the collapse behavior. I want to show you that from this last detection, we can infer the lower limit, a robust lower limit on Newton's star radii. And I also want to point out that in the future, we will be able to measure the maximum mass of non-rotating neutrons. Okay, so what I mean with collapse behavior is just prompt collapse versus no prompt collapse, could be delayed collapse or no collapse at all. You see here two different simulations for the same equation of state. This is 3.5, this is 3.4 solar masses, and you see that this one remains stable at least for a few milliseconds, and this directly forms a black hole. So you would say for this particular equation of state, you have a threshold mass of about 3.45 solar masses. Okay? So to summarize, after the InSpire, you either have a prompt collapse or no collapse or delayed collapse. And you can distinguish these two scenarios also observationally just by the post-merger gravitational wave emission, which you expect to be particularly strong in that case and basically absent in that case.
So can you say a little bit about what's your criteria for when you form a black hole? Because, I mean, even with a Kerr spacetime, there are no conformally flat slices of that, right? So you're just looking at some...
I just look to the central lapse function, and if it's never increasing after merging, but it's forming continuously decreasing, then it's a prompt collapse.
So it just goes towards zero at some point?
Sorry?
It's just going towards zero at some
yes,
point?
Yes,
this is a black hole?
Yes. Okay. And then you I mean, these simulations are done with a static puncture that, I mean, with a static puncture that is moving. So you can also put there a black hole. You can simulate there also a black hole. So the quantity that I want to discuss is this threshold binary mass. So where if you have a total binary mass above this threshold, I have a prompt collapse to a black hole. If you have binary mass below, then you have a delayed collapse or no collapse. Okay? And now it's about understanding how this threshold mass depends on the equation of state. And you can, for all these equations of state, determine this threshold mass just by performing many different simulations, and you can approximately determine this threshold mass. Okay? And you see that it can be somewhere, depending on the equation of state, between about 3 and 4 solar masses. Now it's to understand how this depends on the equation of state, I also list here a few TOV properties of these different equations of state, and now I just start playing around. And for instance, if I plot the threshold mass as a function of the maximum mass of a non-rotating neutron star and this radius of the maximum mass configuration, you see that all these threshold masses nicely lie in this plane. Okay, so you can fit here all these data. These are about 25 equations of state by this such a bilinear function. You can also use here such a fit here, so the threshold mass just expressed as the maximum mass and the radius of the maximum mass configuration. And the fit that works equally well is the threshold mass as a function of the maximum mass and the radius of 1.6 solar masses. They are accurate to about 0.05 solar masses.
Sorry, this is happening?
Sorry?
Why does this happen? They line up on the
plane? So basically, the threshold mass is the determines the stability to black hole formation of this rotating remnant, right? And the maximum mass here that I'm using here is determining the stability of a non-rotating neutron star. So to this, in this sense, it's expected that the threshold mass should increase with this maximum mass. And then the size of the neutron star, so of this remnant, also of course should have an impact, and therefore you also have here this dependence on the radius. So there is no really, I mean, that's an intuitive picture which makes sense, but I cannot give you a really much better explanation than that this is somehow understandable, that the transition to a collapse should depend on the maximum mass and also on the compactness of the remnant. Okay. So now for deriving a neutron star radius constraint, this is the physical argument. So in this observation of the electromagnetic counterpart, You inferred a relatively high ejecta mass compared to simulations. Like certainly it's compatible with what you see in different simulations, but it's certainly at the high end. Okay. And my point is that if you consider all the prompt collapse cases, that even if that was a very asymmetric merger, a prompt collapse could not produce such a high ejecta mass, such a bright optical counterpart. And that's the reason why I would argue that in this particular event, you had either a delayed collapse or no collapse of the merger rep. Okay? So this will be my hypothesis now for the rest, for the next few slides, that there was no direct collapse.
Can you go back for just a second? So looking at this compilation table on the left-hand side, it looks like a lot of these inferences about the dynamical mass are not in agreement with each other.
Yes.
Can you comment on this?
So most of this basically comes from how you interpret the data and how you fit the data. So there are many different models invoked to explain or to fit the data. So people use one spherically symmetric component that is expanding. Some people use two, some people use three. Some try to take into account some asymmetry, some geometrical effects. Some are doing more sophisticated radiative transfer calculations and so on. So these different numbers basically come from different interpretations or different underlying models.
Do you trust any of these?
Not any.
So how confident when you say that there was not a prompt collapse? I mean, do you feel that in your heart that's
yeah. I think it's
how do we know this?
I cannot give you a final proof, that's my point, right? But I think it's really hard to explain this event with a prompt collapse simply because this thing was really very bright and it's really hard to get so much ejecta to get such a overall brightness of the event. So I guess that's a relatively good argument, and I guess most people agree on this, that this was not a prompt collapse. But I mean, as I said, I cannot really give you a final answer, but in the future we will probably get one. And kilohertz gravitational waves are the key. Because if you get a similar event and you measure post-merger gravitational waves, then you can tell what you have.
As you are discussing what happened, after the merger, and of course we do not know, you've probably heard about this possible observation of an X-ray flare by Piero et al. 150 days after this event. Do you have any view, and therefore suggesting that there might still be a neutron star there?
Is that what they're claiming? Is their interpretation?
That's their interpretation. Although if you look at the data, I mean, they haven't published anything yet, but they are going around conferences making these claims. Just by looking by eye at their sort of model, really what model, their experimental data, whether or not you can see a peak in this, for this flare, I think is questionable. But I was just wondering, is it any way on the cards to have a neutron star really that survived, 5 months later? Or would this break all sort of...
If the maximum mass of neutron stars is very high, then it's certainly possible to have a stable neutron star, right?
Okay.
If it's not that high, there are different possibilities, right? You could also have a rigidly rotating remnant at some point, but that is probably very magnetized. And then you have this classical dipole spin down. And if you take magnetar numbers or something like this, then you find that the spin down should lead to a collapse on a timescale of maybe several seconds, minutes or so. But still, this doesn't tell you that a long-lived neutron star is impossible, because if the maximum mass is higher than the 2.73 solar masses, then you can have a stable neutron star. Or you could have anything close to the threshold. So I think theoretically it's not excluded.
It's not that outrageous. I mean, it's pushing things.
Yeah. It's pushing things, huh? It's fine-tuning, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But it's possible.
Okay.
Okay, so believe these numbers or not. Ballpark, they are very high compared to simulations. And if you could look here, for instance, to this is just a dynamical ejector from simulations, you find that if you go to high masses, the ejector mass is already reduced, and that's where you have a prompt collapse. Okay, so that's the reason why I say that this event is incompatible with a direct formation of a black hole. So my argument is that you can distinguish these two cases also by the ejector masses or the brightness of the counterpart, and that this ejector mass was very high, and therefore the measured total binary mass must be smaller than the threshold mass. Okay? So now we can put the things together. If you, this is true, that this was not direct collapse, it means that the threshold mass is larger than the measured total binary mass. The next thing that we need is this empirical relation between the threshold mass and the maximum mass and the radius of a neutron star. And then we need a third piece, and that's causality, which tells us that the speed of sound is smaller than the speed of light. And that gives you here a very robust limit connecting the maximum mass and the radius of the maximum mass configuration. So now, if this was not a direct collapse, it means that the measured total binary mass, 2.73 solar masses, is smaller than this expression here, okay? Now we can insert the maximum mass here and here, and you see that on the right-hand side, there's only the radius left, which implies that the measured binary mass puts a lower limit on neutron star radii, okay? Here you see it visualized, the same argument, but if you put it together, you see that you can rule out here very small neutron star radii, simply because if radii were smaller, you had a direct collapse in that event, and I argued it's maybe not the case. You can also consider here this other empirical relation, which includes here the radius of 1.6 solar mass neutron star. You make the same argument, construct a causality argument, which connects the maximum mass and the radius of non-rotating neutron star with 1.6 solar mass neutron stars, and you get here a constraint on the radius of a 1.6 solar mass neutron star. So this radius must be larger than about 11 kilometers, because otherwise you had a direct collapse in this event. So this excludes very soft nuclear matter. And you can now, on top, plot also the constraint that you get from the tidal form.
The recent tidal, like LIGO paper on this tidal log number measurement, they have similar numbers, right?
Yeah, Yeah, but that's a number that I think comes mostly from imposing that there is a maximum mass of two solar masses, right? It's not that you really measured a lower bound, at least that's my understanding, right?
I don't remember exactly the numbers. It seems it's like 11 kilometers.
I think it was a little bit less, because you see that you can construct here, there exist equations of state which are very soft, very small radii, and they can reach the two solar masses. So I think this equation of state cannot be excluded by the LIGO measurement. So
basically, you are saying that if you allow very high threshold mass or maximum mass, this star has to be very stiff.
Not very stiff. It must be sufficiently, I mean, it must be larger than this 11 kilometers or 10.7.
So stiff stars have larger radii.
Stiff stars have larger radii, yeah. So the tidal deformability tells us that it cannot be extremely stiff. But this argument, if you believe or not whether there was no direct collapse, then it tells you that the equation of state can also not be extremely soft.
Uh-huh. So is it possible that somehow, there is a tension between the tidal log number measurement and this?
No, not at all, because, I mean, it's just that the tidal deformability constrains radii from above, and this argument constrains radii from below, and you see that there are still many equations of state which are compatible with both constraints. And that's ideally something that you want to do in the future, right? You want to constrain radii from above and below. I guess my time is already up.
I think it's fine. I mean, the lunch is 90 minutes, so we can just...
Yeah.
Another 10 minutes, probably fine.
as you want, as long as you're not bored.
Who's actually hungry? Well, that's right, you have very small practice. Oh, you're fine.
That's compromise. the point that I want to make is that I think thinking about this collapse behavior has some potential for the future, because so if there was a delayed collapse or not is something that you can test with more refined models of the emission. And as we will observe more events in the future, we will also get a much better understanding of which events led to a direct collapse and which didn't. Because so what I expect is that in at some point we have 10 events, and if you order them by mass, you will see low mass, large brightness, high brightness, and then at some point you get this drop, and this probably tells you where you had the threshold for a prompt collapse. So I think we will understand this collapse behavior much better from the observations in the future. And this is also where the kilohertz gravitational waves become important, because of this is clearly the smoking gun for the collapse behavior. Let me just mention, since this relies only on the measured binary masses, this is relatively robust, because you have these error bars relatively well under control. Of course, you need to argue if magnetic fields or more sophisticated treatment of neutrinos can have an impact on the threshold mass. But I mean, my feeling is that it's really hard to push the magnetic fields into a regime where they can really affect such a bulk property like the threshold mass. So the interesting thing about this method of constraining Newton's law radii is that it only requires basically a low SNR gravitational wave detection, because you only need the mass measurement and then you take the other information from the electromagnetic counterpart. And so you just need more events, you don't need necessarily louder events, and that's complementary to all the other equation of state constraints from gravitational waves. And as I said, we can really expect that in the future we will understand this collapse behavior much better. And to give you an idea of what we can expect in the future, for instance, if you had two events, one with clear signature of a delayed collapse and a total boundary mass of 2.9 solar masses, then you had another event with a very dim electromagnetic counterpart and a total boundary mass of 3.1 solar masses, then the corresponding constraints are shown here in that hypothetical case. So if you had a prompt collapse and you constrain Newton's law radii from above, and you also constrain the maximum mass from above. And if you had such two events, then these are the exclusion regions. And you see that then there are really not many equations of state which are compatible with these things. So I think this is really something that could be very interesting in the future. And a comment on the maximum mass. So going back to this mass, to this empirical relation that determines or that describes the threshold mass as a function of the maximum mass and the radius of 1.6 solar mass neutron stars. So sooner or later, we will measure this radius of a neutron star in one way or the other. Could be NICER, could be also LIGO, post-merger accreditation wave emission, or better tidal deformability. So at some point, we will know this number. And at some point, we will also determine this number, because if you measure more events, you measure the boundary mass, and you check if you found post-merger emission or not, this tells you what is the threshold mass. And then you can invert this relation and it can give you this maximum mass here. Okay? So that's something where post-merger accreditation wave emission is really important. It can tell you if you had a prompt collapse or not. And that can then be used to determine the threshold mass. And I think it's really important to determine it, because this is maybe the only way to learn something about this maximum mass, which tells you something about the very high density regime of a neutron star. And I don't think that it's very easy to determine this maximum mass otherwise. I mean, maybe we'll get more pulsar observations in the future. We will maybe get heavier stars. But this only gives you a lower limit on the maximum mass. But what you also need is a limit from above. So I think it would be really nice to get a better idea about this threshold mass here. Okay. I guess I can skip this. This is just to show you what you can get if you measure for several events the peak frequency, because the peak frequency, so this dominant peak frequency increases with the binary mass. These are different, every line is a different equation of state, and you see they all terminate here on this threshold mass. And you see if you measure here two different events, you can extrapolate along this line, determine the intersection, and the intersection gives you the threshold mass. So by measuring different peak frequencies, you can also get this threshold mass. And as I argue, this threshold mass gives you the maximum mass. Okay, I guess I skipped this. And I directly leave you with my conclusions. I just want really to make the point that really it would be really great if we are able to measure kilohertz gravitational waves, because they can really tell us Newton star radii very accurately and can give us complementary information on the equation of state. And then finally, we can also connect it to the electromagnetic signature of a neutron star merger, and also this maximum mass is something that we can possibly get from measuring post-merger and kilohertz gravitational waves. Thank you.
Questions? Considering you mentioned NICER, and they are analyzing data, I think, right now, and they said that this summer we'll know something. How do those, well, one can only guess right now those results, but how do they fit into this picture? Can you comment on that? I mean, their target is one system or a handful of systems.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, will they, how does it fit in this entire picture of measuring equation of state and so on, radii?
I think they claimed always that they can measure neutron star radii with a precision of a few percent, right? Which is more or less compatible with what we discussed here, right? If we believe them and if they think that they have the systematic errors under control, like magnetic field geometry and so on, which could all have an impact on the exact emission of these hotspots, then I mean it would be probably interesting to see if these in a few years, if these different measurements agree, right? I mean, at the moment.
I mean, is there a reason to believe that all the neutron stars are controlled by the same equation of state?
That's pretty much depending on how crazy you want to be. I mean, so there is, for instance, this idea
no,
that.
I don't want to be silly crazy. I mean.
No, I mean, there is this idea that there could be absolutely stable strange quark matter, right? And then there is the question if mergers of strange stars produce strangelets that would possibly convert all existing neutron stars actually to strange stars, right? Or if these strangelets are not produced, if they dissolve after the ejection, or if they dissolve when they interact with the microwave background and so on. So in principle, at least, there is the possibility that neutron stars and strange stars could coexist. And then you could have the situation that compact stars are really described by two different equations of state. But...
Okay, I answered. All right.
Any more questions? People are hungry. okay, let's thank Andreas again.